Thank you, Mr. Holloway. Good morning. Do I say good morning to Buffalo or no? Tartu? Tartu, yes. I don't understand technology. You can't get to Buffalo, but we can go to Tartu, right? Well, good morning or good evening to Tartu. I was thinking whenever I speak and the video is going, I guess I get a little paranoid that I'm going to be making some stupid move, you know, and it get frozen like that for the whole, you know, the lose the signal there. So, but I guess that's not going to happen. You know, as you all know, I go into New York City. I used to do it 5 nights a week. Now I'm down to 3 nights a week. But as I go across the George Washington Bridge, I can look over to the right, and I can see the World Trade Center, the new building that they're building. And it's all lit up at night. The whole thing is lit up. Every floor is lit up. It's up to, I don't know, 90-something or 100 floors now. I guess it's taller than the Empire State Building now because they put a big tower on top. But when I go by at night, I can see it. You know, they're working on the reason why they have the lights on. I hear guys talk on the radio, oh, that's a waste of electricity. But what they're doing, they're working on it 24-7, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And they're progressing at one floor a week. And so I've been watching it for a while. And as I go downtown, I can really see them progress. And I can remember the old towers. I remember I used to deliver down just maybe 15 blocks away, and I used to be amazed at the two towers there. And I never dreamed in my wildest dreams that they would come down. I often thought if they had a big hurricane, how much would that sway? You know, that's the way I was thinking, well, looking at those buildings. But after they went down, it changed the whole atmosphere of downtown Manhattan. There was... you know, after the towers went down, I went down there and there was police, there was firemen, there was trailers there. That they had a number of refrigerated trailers. They were going to use that for a temporary morgue. And just getting into New York was a problem. All the trucks had to stop and the police had to look inside and to check to see what you had in there. And when you went downtown, there was national, you know, after the first couple of days, it was National Guard all over the place. And the whole atmosphere was changed. It was quiet. You could see the smoke billowing up from, you know, just it was like I said, it was a few blocks away. And it was all lit up and you see the smoke coming up. And it burned for like 3 months. And it was really quiet. There was no horns blowing. People were, I think, humbled. People would say hello to you, which was really odd going there. And people would smile at you. And it was just a humbling experience. And then one day they sent me to Staten Island. And what they wanted to do, me to do, is go to where they were dumping all this debris from the World Trade Center. And they wanted me to pick up these steel beams that were in the tower, and they were bent all out of shape. And what they were going to use them for is send them to all over the country for memorials, different cities in the country. And I can remember going up there, and it was this giant. Well, it was Staten Island. It was they used to have dumps out there anyway, but this was separate from the other ones. And the thing must have been 100 feet high. And it must have been like when I got to the top, it was flat on top, but it was like a half a mile wide and long. And when I got there, they were still working at cleaning the debris. And what they had these big conveyors, and they had people working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, sifting through this debris. They were trying to find remains. Physical remains and remains of, you know, like wallets or people they can identify. And I was talking to a police officer there, and he said they had dogs there. They called them cadaver dogs. And they had quite a few of them, and looking for signs of people. And I guess it was all, death was all around, and these dogs would smell it, but they couldn't find it because there was nothing left. There was the smell of death, but there was nobody there. And then, and they said the dogs got depressed. I didn't think a dog could get depressed, but they really got depressed, and they were hurting their feet from climbing all over these things. But I guess my point is that I see now that they're building the new tower. And as I said, the new tower, they got some new safety and security. Along with the protection offered by the reinforced concrete base, this is the new tower that they're building now because they don't want any problems. There's a reinforced concrete base. A number of other safety features were included in the building's design in order to better prepare it for a major accident or a terrorist attack. These features include 3 feet thick reinforced concrete walls for all stairwells, elevator shafts, risers, and sprinkler systems. Extra wide 4 to 5 stairwells. A dedicated set of stairwells exclusively for the use of the firefighters. And biological and chemical filters throughout its ventilation system. The building is no longer 25 feet away from the West Street as the Twin Towers were. At its closest point, West Street is 65 feet away. The windows on the side of the building facing in the direction are equipped with specially tempered blast-resistant plastic, which looks nearly the same as the glass used in the other side of the buildings. Excuse me. The 70 elevators and 9 escalators for World One World Trade Center was provided by, well, it gives you a name there, with steel counterweights supplied by Concord Steel. The Port Authority has stated its structure is designed around a strong, redundant steel monument frame consisting of beams and columns connected by a combination of welding and bolting. Paired with a concrete core shear wall, the monument frame lends substantial rigidity and redundancy to the overall building structure, which provides column-free interior spans for maximum flexibility. I guess the point of my sermonette, brethren, if you want an SPS for a title, or, you know, as we go through these, I want to talk about trials, and as we go through trials, there could be a number of things: health, family, death of a loved one, personal problems, spiritual and financial problems that knocks us down. And are we looking for God's help? And are we helping ourselves with God's help, just like the World Trade Center? Are we rising up stronger? You know, I was reading about President Lincoln and his humble beginnings. You know, I think we all read and heard about how the president's political career, early his political career, how he'd run for Senate, lost, or Congress. You know, I forget all the details there, but he lost a lot of races. But he stayed the course, and he became one of the greatest presidents in history. And during the last few weeks of his presidency, he had the weight of the world on his shoulders. The Civil War was ending, and he had to make hard, major decisions about decisions concerning the South after their surrender. A lot of people in the North wanted the South to pay physically and monetarily for the war. They were bitter. They were angry. And he was busy president at that time. People wanted his time for many reasons. He had a White House full of people they would stay there overnight. He let people come in overnight and stay there. They would sleep on the floors so they could be first to see him when he was ready to see people. So there was people there all the time. 24 hours a day, they wanted his time. They wanted him to fix their problems. He was dealing with the death of his two sons. He had a severely depressed wife who wanted his time and needed his time. And he tried to spend time with her. He was losing weight, skin and bones. And he knew that he was going to be assassinated. He had a vivid dream, he told his wife and friends closest to him. And he knew in his heart of hearts that he was going to die. But with all this going on, every morning he would get up early and go to his study. And he would kind of sneak around and go to his study because people wanted his time. And he would go there and lock the door, and he would seek God. As they say, he'd take his dog-eared Bible. It was used so much, it was dog-eared. And he would seek God's wisdom every day. So, brethren, how is our contact? How is our conduct in the midst of suffering? You know, if we turn to 1 Peter 2:19, you know, we can use Abraham Lincoln there as an example. We have problems, but are we seeking God? Are we seeking God first? Looking, praying, and seeking his wisdom in all things. In 1 Peter chapter 2, we'll start in verse 19. Verse 19. And this chapter is talking about how is our conduct, how is the people's conduct in the midst of suffering. Verse 19. For this is thankworthy. If a man for conscience toward God endure grief, suffering wrongfully, for what glory is it if, when ye buffeted for your faults, you shall take it patiently? But if, when ye do well and suffer for it, ye take it patiently, this is acceptable with God. Verse 21. For even unto where you were called, Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that we should follow in his steps. Now, Peter's not saying that suffering is a commendable thing. What is commendable is that the one has to be submitted to God's will, and that he is suffering, not because, you know, using Christ as an example, not because he did something wrong, but because he did something right. In addition, he's not striking back, which is what his emotion would lead him to do. And also, if we turn to Genesis 22, verse 1, it talks about Abraham and all the trials that Abraham went through. Genesis 22, verse 1. And it came to pass, after these things, that God did tempt Abraham and said unto him, Abraham, he said, behold. And Abraham said, behold, here I am. And he said, now take thy son, thy only son Isaac, whom thou lovest, and get thee into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of these mountains, which I will tell you. You know, I think we know the story. But here, God is testing Abraham's obedience again. You know, it says, in the very beginning of that verse, it says, and it became to pass after these things. After what things have passed? What has passed was the whole interesting story of the life of Abraham up to this point. It has been said that to follow God, Abraham gave up more than any other man. Now at age 133, he is looking back on a lifetime of trials. Perhaps he thought that he proved his faith. and he could kind of relax a bit, enjoy his old age. But God, however, had another test for him, the biggest test yet. Though God does not tempt us, he does test us. Nevertheless, Abraham eagerly responded when God called his name and said, "Here I am." What tremendous humility this shows. You know, we can look in James 1, verse 3. You don't have to turn. I just read it. Knowing this, that trying of your faith, working patience. And Abraham proved that he had plenty of faith. Our warfare is in many different ways. It doesn't have to involve bloody engagements featuring swords or spears or rifles or bayonets. You know, for us, brethren, it's a spiritual warfare, one that takes primarily within ourselves. Nevertheless, it requires qualities such as loyalty, patriotism, courage, self-denial, vision, understanding, and sacrifice for us to become overcomers. Now, if you turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 16, 1 Corinthians chapter 16. And we'll start in verse 13. 16:13. Watch ye, stand fast in the faith, quit you like men, and be strong. Paul is giving us a command here. There are four imperatives in this one verse, which in itself, just six words in the original Greek. The first one was watch. Second was stand fast in the faith. Third, be men, courageous. And the fourth was be strong. The first one, the word watch, to keep awake, be vigilant, be watchful. For us, that means keeping an eye open on the world around us, and more importantly, paying attention to our spiritual condition. The second one was stand fast in the faith. It means to be stationary, anchored, to preserve, to be convicted for our beliefs. The third one, be men, be courageous, but not so much as a physical sense as in the convictions of our spiritual life. And the fourth one was to be strong, impulsive, to increase in vigor, to be strengthened, to increase in faith. You know, a few weeks ago, I went to the library, and I got a couple of books out, and I looked in the movie section. I thought, well, I'll bring a movie home. And I saw the movie 300 Spartans. And it's an old movie, okay? It's in the 50s or 60s, and that always interested me, that story. So I thought, well, I'll bring this home and we'll watch that. Well, the movie stunk. It really did stink. The acting was, you know, below average. I have to say below average, but, you know, it was overacting. And I know I watched it, and Judy, we sat down to watch it, and Judy said, "Why do you pick these movies?" She couldn't watch it. She ended up reading it. I couldn't finish it. You know, I never did finish the movie. I ended up turning it off. But, you know, like I said, the story really interested me. The 300 Spartans. You know, it was the Battle of Thermopylae in 480 BC when a Spartan king, King Leonidas, and his 300 Spartans, along with 700 Thespians and 400 Thebans, and perhaps a few hundred others, fought to the death against a million-man army of the Persian Empire, Emperor Xerxes. And I know there was a little pass that they had to the Million Marm, you know, to get to Sparta or the rest of them, they had to go through this pass, and they were defending this pass, and how they sent battalion after army after army, and these Spartans fought back. But they fought against these men, and King Leonidas and his men knew that they would die, and they knew the odds were overwhelming against them, but they felt compelled to stop the enemy and save their country. And also, I read a story about which interested me also, the Cheyenne Indians of the 1800s, living on the Great Plains of the United States, and had six warrior societies. Perhaps, you know, I'm sure we heard the story, perhaps the greatest of these were known as the Dog Soldiers. They were described as Spartans of the Plains. Each man wore a sash around his waist, and they called it, a dog rope, with a picket pin at the end. The picket pin was a pointed stake, typically tied to the end of the rope, you know, that most people would use this, and the other Indians use this, that'd be driven in the ground to tether a horse, which would graze and not wander off. In the case of the Dog Soldiers, the pin was driven into the ground as much as a mark of resolve in combat. When a Dog Soldier was staked to the ground in order to cover the retreat of his companions, he was required to remain there, even if death was the consequence. The dog men could pull the pin from the ground only if his companions reached safety, or another dog soldier released him from his duty. You know, these are great examples of watching, stand fast, as well as being strong and courageous. You know, brother, we need to like Abraham Lincoln did, study the Bible, brother, and take time to study and to pray to God. I don't know, maybe I've told this story, maybe I haven't, but I was in Brooklyn one day and I delivered to a place, and when I came, I've been doing this for quite a few years. And when I came out of this place, I would make a right-hand turn because it was hard to make a left-hand turn. So I would go down the street, and one day I went down there, and it was some like DOT officers or police, and they pulled me over. And they said, "You're not allowed to be on the street." And I said, "Well, I didn't know that." He says, "Hold on, I'll be back." And he gave me a ticket for being on the street that I wasn't supposed to be. And I said, "You know, I don't understand that." I said, "There was no signs, nothing to tell me that I couldn't be on the street." And I said, "You know, I really don't agree with this ticket. You know, you got to have something to tell me." And he said, "Tell it to the judge." And so I said, "I think I will." And so I got the ticket, and I pleaded not guilty. I sent it in, and I got a notice in the mail. I got like 3-4 notices in the mail where they postponed it. They kept postponing it, so I forgot about it. And I remembered one day, like the day before, I was supposed to go to this court because it postponed so many times. And I had to go because in New York State, if you don't go to court or pay the ticket, they can arrest you. And I didn't want to be arrested. So I was going down to the city that day. So I went over to Brooklyn and tried to find a parking spot for something 70 feet long in Brooklyn. So I rode around there for an hour trying to find a parking spot. I ended up parking like a mile away and walking through really nice sections of Brooklyn, you know. So and when I got there, I got there a little early, and there was a line outside. There must have been four, 500 people waiting to go into court. And I thought, man, I'm going to be here forever. And so I thought, man, by the time I get back to my truck, it's either going to be gone or I'm going to have a parking ticket. So, but once they opened the doors and moved fast, and they had several courtrooms, and I was the first on the list. So I went to court. I went into the court, and the police officer was there. I was hoping he wasn't, so they would throw it out. But at this point, I just wanted to be done with it. You know, I was over being mad, you know, months ago. So I just wanted to get this done. And so I explained my case to the judge. He asked me, and I explained my case. And I said, you know, there's no signs telling me that I couldn't go on the street. And he says, there doesn't have to be. I said, it doesn't have to be. He says, nope, it doesn't have to be. And he took his book out. And it was about as thick as that, but about this big, thick as the Bible. And then he opened it up to the street that I was on. And he says, it says right here, you're not supposed to be on that street. And I said, well, you know, I said, I don't know. I don't. He says, well, he says, I'll tell you what. He says, you better get this book. And he says, you better plan your trip accordingly. Take this book and plan your trip accordingly. And he said it to me twice for emphasis. And he said, guilty. Hit his gavel, $200. So nothing I could do. But I thought about that. Okay? I thought about that. How I'm supposed to plan my trip accordingly. You know, as Abraham Lincoln did, are we planning our life? Are we planning our life according to this? Are we using the Bible to course our life? So that was just a story I like to tell you, but I don't know if I used that before, but if I did, I didn't mean to bore you. So, but if we turn to Hebrews, verse 11, chapter 11, verse 6, verse 36, Hebrews 11, verse 6. These are great heroes of faith and trials of the faithful. Hebrews 11, 6. Hebrews verse 11, verse 36. Okay. Verse 36. And this is talking about trials of the faithful. And others had trials of cruel mockings and scourgings, yea, and moreover of the bonds and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn asunder, they were tempted, were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not really worthy. They wandered in the desert and in the mountains and in the dens and the caves of the earth. And these people, all having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise. You know, verses 36 to 38, this lists various trials God has required of some of the faithful, especially notice verse 39. All of these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise. Even though all looked lost from the human standpoint, they still believed God, knowing that the sovereign God could and would keep his promise even beyond the grave. With all God's promises, he does not promise when he will answer. The timing of those answers are in his hands based on what's best for us. God decides when even the end, death, could be the last piece of proof God requires to know we can trust us with eternal and everlasting relationship with him. But then if we also turn to Revelation chapter 3, and we'll start in verse 10. Revelation 3, verse 10. Because thou hast kept the word of my patience, I will also keep thee from thy hour of temptation, from which shall come upon all the world, to try them and to dwell upon the earth. The word translated kept or keep, used twice, plays into this. The word means to attend carefully, to maintain, to guard, to hold fast, and the way that is used to indicate reciprocity. I had trouble with that word. I had asked Judy how to pronounce that. Reciprocity. Reciprocity. Okay. We certainly want to guard, hold fast, and carefully attend to us. We would prefer that he guard us and hold us far away from the destruction and torment that will come upon us, upon his people. But the flip side is that he wants us to do the same thing. Keep guard, hold fast, with regard to our responsibilities to the covenant. In other words, if we want God to take an active interest in our well-being during that time, we should understand the principle and take an active interest in him at this time. We diligently guard the things he has committed to our trust. He will do the same for us. What I'd like to do now, brother, is finish something I started the last sermon that I gave during the Holy Day. I talked about Louis Zampini, and I finished the book. And to be honest with you, brother, that's one of the best books I've ever listened to. You know, I listen to a lot of books, but it was the best book, and it was a true story. And what I like to do is finish what I was saying about Lou Zampini because it made such an impression on me. Just to recap a few things and review a few things, he was born in Olean, New York, just up the road. And he was literally moved to California. And as he moved to California, he became a troubled child, constantly running into problems with the police and neighbors. But his brother had talked him into channel that into running, and he became a great runner. He broke high school and college records. He made the 1938 Olympics, and then he was drafted into the Army Air Corps. He was shot down in the Pacific. Out of a crew of, I think, 10, I think there's only three that survived the crash. They crashed. They were shot down over the Pacific, and they crashed in the Pacific. And it was three of them with two rafts, a raft just big enough for actually one person. They drifted for 27 days with no food and no water. But they would catch rainwater, and every once in a while they would catch – it would catch these little fish that were feeders on sharks. You know, you see sharks running around and you see those little feeder fish cleaning them off. And it was constant. For 27 days, it was constant that these sharks were circling these rafts. And they would rub up against the raft with their fins. And it was a constant reminder that they were there. And after 27 days, they saw a plane come over. And they thought they were saved. So they had a flare gun. They shot the flare, but it was an enemy plane. It was a Japanese plane. So they decided, the Japanese came, and they decided, you know, use them for target practice. So after 27 days, surviving 27 days, they came back two or three times shooting at them with 50 caliber machine gun. And Louis, he would dive off to the side. He didn't know what to do, stay on the raft or go in with the sharks. So remarkably, they hit the raft many times, put holes in the raft, but nobody was shot. And finally, they got tired of it, and they took off. And so now they were floating around in the middle of the Pacific on a raft with holes in it. And they had a little patch kit and a little pump, and they patched it as best as they can. And they were on the water for for another 17 days like that. And they would pump. They would pump this until I finally patched all the holes. But for days, they had to pump this raft to keep it afloat. And they finally made land. But it was a land that was occupied by the Japanese. And they were picked up by like a Japanese PT boat. And they were thrown in a hole in the ground. And they were in there for weeks and weeks, just this hole in the ground. And they would be spit upon. They would be in their own waste. And they would throw them a ball of rice that was maggot infested. And that's what they were living on. And every once in a while, the submarine crew would come and dock for there a while. And they would take it out on, because they were mad, they would take these prisoners out and beat them. And from there, he stayed there about 3 weeks. And he was taken to Japan as a POW. And when he went to Japan as a POW, they knew he was famous. Somebody had recognized him. One of the Japanese had recognized him. And there was this one guard there. He was crazy. He was crazy, and he was a sadist. And he loved to beat people. And he made Louis Zampini his target. And every chance he got, he would beat him. Beat him with sticks and rocks and belts and do all kinds of things to him. And this went on for like a year and a half. And you wonder how a man can survive that. And it wasn't only him, but the Japanese were really mean to these prisoners. And then the war was over, and the prisoners were liberated. And he came home. He came home to his family. His family thought he was dead. In fact, they had they call it the Lou Zampini Memorial, which he attended. They thought he was dead. The Lou Zampini Memorial race. They had a race and a memorial to him, and he ended up coming to this race. And so things were going better. He found a wife. He married, and had a child. But after that, the nightmares came. This guard, one particular guard, came, and he would have these flashbacks and nightmares every night. He couldn't sleep. And the only way he can get rid of this is by drinking. He became a drunk to sleep, and it affected his whole life. He couldn't find it. He couldn't hold a job. They gave him speaking engagements, tell a story, but that kind of faltered after a while because of the way he was. His wife left him at least two or three times, and they came, and she'd come back hoping that she can help him. And his whole being at that time was to go back to Japan. What he wanted to do was go back to Japan to find this guard and to kill him. And that was his whole purpose in life. He thought that would make him feel better. But one day, his wife came home, and she said she attended a revival, this tent where it was a young man, president of a college, was going around giving this revival, setting up this big tent. It was Billy Graham. It was Billy Graham, and she tried to get his Louis to go, but he wouldn't go. She harped on him and harped on him. Finally, he said yes, said yes to going, just to shut her up. So he won once, and he didn't like what he was saying. He said that God loved him, and how things would go good. God would love you. And he thought about it and made him mad because he thought that God would trip him up. God has tripped him up all his life, and God wasn't fair to him. And so he refused to go again. But after a while, his neighbors and his wife were really getting on his case and wanted him to go. And so he went again. And Billy Graham started talking about how God created the universe. and how he created everything. And he knows people. He knows how people think and knows how people are. And that he can number, he knows you that much. He can number the hair he knows the number of hairs on your head. He knows you that much and he loves you. And he had enough of that. He said, I don't want to listen to this. And he was walking out. And Billy Graham said something, that God does love you and God does know you. And he remembered something. And it hit him like a ton of bricks. It slapped him like in the face. He remembered that on that raft, he was about 30 days on that raft, just laying there, dying, starving to death and dying of thirst. He told God that if God would save him, that I really get emotional over this, you know, reading this book, that God would save him, that he would commit his life to him. And at that moment, he remembered that. When Billy Graham said that, he remembered that. And it changed his whole life at that point. It really changed his life. He went home and dumped all his liquor, and he stopped smoking, and he got along with his wife. But he did dedicate, after that, he dedicated his life to God, to serving God. He got along with his, you know, everything was going well. He slept. He slept without these dreams, without these nightmares. And I guess my whole point of this story, brethren, you know, really, maybe I'm boring you with it, but it just goes to show you that no matter what happens in life, God will be there for you. God will really be there for you, and you need to remember that. You know, brethren, in closing, you know, I started out with the World Trade Center and how that was knocked down and was built back stronger. It was knocked down. And how about us, brethren, as we get knocked down, are we getting up stronger? So, brethren, let's remember. Let's take the time, just like Lincoln did, and just like that judge told me, to take this book and plan our life accordingly.